What's up and welcome back to the Locked On Bucks podcast. I am James Yarko, joined as always by David Harrison. David, how you doing?
I think I'm doing about as good as everybody else is.
So really bad.
Yeah.
Okay. You can find us on Twitter at the Pewter Plank, at Locked On Bucks. I'm at @JYarko_Bucks, and David is at @DH82_Bucks. We are, of course, coming off of a wonderful 26-20 overtime loss to the Green Bay Packers, and wow. For the first time this season, David, the Bucks did something like complimentary and complete as an entire football team. They all stunk. Like the whole, this was like a whole team loss. The offense was bad. The defense was bad. Even the special teams were bad outside of Pat Murray because, you know, Anger had his punt blocked. But, I mean, the thing that boggled my mind going through social media is there's people that want to pinpoint it strictly on the offense because they only scored 20 points when it should have been a whole lot more, and it should have been. There's people that want to pinpoint it strictly on the defense because the defense – couldn't stop a nosebleed in two of the, you know, final three Packers possessions, which is also true. Whereas really this was just a complimentary complete loss on both sides of the football. What is your biggest takeaway from this abomination that we call a football team?
Yeah, exactly what you just said. Both sides deserve equal parts of the blame. And I think that both sides should get equal parts of the blame. I don't feel like any one side of the ball really lost the game for the team. And like you said, that's kind of a rarity in itself and a new kind of occurrence, because in most of the games, looking back at the season, you've had one unit that played really well, and then you had the other unit that just couldn't do anything. So, you know, it's just one more frustration to add on to the list of frustrations, but I guess at least for those who have been rallying for a change at running back, you know, today is going to kind of become their banner that they hold up during the offseason, saying that Doug Martin couldn't get it done because look at what Peyton Barber did today.
There's a certain outlet that you already know which one it is that was pumping that narrative real hard this
afternoon. Yeah, oh yeah, and I'm sure, and they're not alone. You know, there's plenty of fans who've just been waiting for a Peyton Barber game like this, you know, to go over 100 yards, and he had, 140 from scrimmage combined, I think, somewhere around that ballpark.
He had 102 rushing and 41 receiving. He was the leading rusher and receiver for the Bucks today.
Yeah, I mean, discredit to Peyton Barber. I mean, I've been a fan of Peyton's, you know, since he came into the team. You know, a kid who has that drive and a kid who has that self-confidence to be able to do what he did and leave Auburn, becoming an undrafted free agent when he could have come back and been the feature back at his school and potentially come into the next draft as a third round draft pick, or, you know, even a fourth round draft pick. You're going to make substantially more money than he did coming out as undrafted free agent, but he bet on himself. And so far it looks like he bet correctly. You know, and eventually he's going to cash in on that bet. So more than happy, you know, plenty of happiness coming from my side about Peyton Barber. In fact, I picked him up in fantasy just because who knows what's going to come in the playoffs, you know. But it's just at this point we're all kind of reaching for what we think is going to fix the franchise. And at the end of the day, it's up to the Glazers to really take what they're hearing, because I know they're paying attention. You know, they're businessmen or it's a business family, you know, and if you're going to run a successful business, you got to know what your customers think. It doesn't necessarily mean you're going to do everything your customers want, but the people that are consuming your product are going to kind of tell you where you're at in your business model. And that's going to help drive your decision making. So they're paying attention. It's just what they agree with, what they disagree with, how they see things compared to how the fans and the media and everybody else sees it. That's going to dictate the way they make their decisions. So it's an interesting offseason one way or another. No matter what, we're going to have plenty to talk about, plenty to write about, and there's going to be plenty of news throughout the Buccaneer season. But I don't think that we're going to see a hype train get going like we did, you know, during the summer of 2017.
Oh, no, there's no way. There's no
weeks away.
I shouldn't say that. If the Bucks clean house, which I firmly believe is going to happen now, and they hire Gruden, the hype train will be in fifth gear all summer long. Because there are too many people that are too excited about the sheer notion of John Gruden coming back and coaching this offense to slow that hype train down. But that's a conversation for another day. Some of the things that I wanted to jump into here, David, is, of course, one of my big complaints and a big complaint among Buccaneers fans is how absolutely atrocious this defense is when it comes to third downs. Against the Packers, they only allowed 5 of 12 third down conversions.
Yeah.
They did a semi-decent job of stopping them on third down, except in those crucial drives when they really needed to stop the most. I mean, they had the opportunity. It was in their hands. They were on the field with a lead, and all you had to do was force them to punt, and the way Barber was running the ball, the Bucs could have iced this game.
Yeah.
Very possible. Very probable. Couldn't get it done. Let Green Bay march down the field, tie the game. Bucs get the ball. Evan Smith forgets what team he plays for. Yeah, what a disaster Evan Smith was. Basically killed any shot of a game-winning drive there. And then the Bucs don't even see the ball in overtime. But the third down defense was slightly improved. You had a Buccaneers team that outgained the Packers by 120 yards. They dominated the time of possession by over 10 minutes. The turnover battle was a wash. One turnover for each team. The Bucs had 25 first downs. Green Bay only had 16. Yet they still lost. It's, as I said on Twitter, it's borderline impressive how bad this team is. So my big issue is the fact that, number one, the offense couldn't punch the ball in the end zone when they had ample opportunity. But is that on the shoulders of Jameis Winston, which many who are going to find ways to blame Jameis regardless? Is it on the shoulders of the fact that the offensive line let more people pass them than the ticket takers at Lambeau? Is it on the play calling? Because I personally believe that this was one of Cutter's better called games this season, if not the best called game. And they did exactly what you and I talked about on Friday in our preview. The quick passing game. The dinks and the dunks let Jameis get the ball out of his hand fast so that this offensive line doesn't have the opportunity to let him get attacked. Instead, he gets hit 13 times, sack 7. I mean, what would you pinpoint the offensive ineptitude on for this loss?
So I still believe, all right, for before I say this, I agree with you. I think this is one of the better called games that Dirk Cutter's had this season. You know, sitting here watching the play selection. I mean, there were some events, you know, there were some occasions where I kind of believe, you know, me personally, my own football theory, I had gone a different direction and so on and so forth. But being a different kind of person saying I would have attacked that differently is not the same as being just utterly confused and dumbfounded by what your head coach is doing. And that's not where I got at any point today, I don't think. So I want to say that before I say the rest of this. And I think it goes back to the scheme. I think it goes back to Dirk Cutter's offense and what this offense is trying to accomplish with its play designs and with just its ideas of how to attack a defense. There were more checkdowns and there were more short passes. I'll give you that. And I was happy to see it too. You know, the very first drive where they ended up scoring a touchdown, there were two back-to-back checkdown passes. And I remember being in the Peter Plank, you know, private message and more than one of us, you know, typed in messages of happiness and jubilation that we saw some checkdown plays. And ultimately what that did is it did exactly what the short passing game is designed to do. And it forced the defense to keep their eyes short, and it forced the defense to pay attention to those closer routes. And eventually you end up with a big play right down the seam that, you know, the Buccaneers love to run to Cameron Brate for the first score of the game, you know, and that's exactly how you play. And that's exactly how you run an offense to set up the defense to do what you're trying to do. Again, the problem goes back to one of two things. Either Dirk Cutter's scheme is too reliant on attacking down the field, and defenses know this, so they start to kind of back off and play off, and then Jameis just plays into the scheme, and you know, then he falls into the waiting arms of a defender. Or Jameis Winston himself is just too fixated on making big plays, and you know, as we've said, trying to get all the points back on one play, or trying to get all the yards back on one play, that he is, you know, instead of reading the defense the way he's supposed to, or that he should, which is more effective for his offense, he's trying to be that hero. And, you know, I'll tell you, most of the guys who become heroes don't necessarily set out to be those heroes, you know, and it's just kind of a self-defeating effort if you're out there just actively, you know, okay, this is going to be the play where I put myself in NFL history or Buccaneers team history by making this amazing play. That's no way to do it. And if you look at Jameis Winston's history, you see that really, for the most part, he's better when he's not thinking. Like that play of the year, I don't want that to sound rude, but the play of the year last year, right? That crazy scramble that he had, and it was against the Bears, right? Where he kind of went in the end zone for a minute, came back out, and then hurled the ball down to Mike Evans.
Yeah.
You can't tell me, like, that dude is just literally running off of instinct. It's just fight or flight at that time. You can't fight in the NFL because you get ejected. So what is he doing? He's running. He's flying around the field, avoiding defenders, and then boom, he sees an opportunity, hurls the ball downfield, and you saw what happened. But look at – so we talked about the first drive, right? First drive, you got two check down passes. You had some runs sprinkled in there. It was really great. The Packers started playing up, and boom, you hit him with Cam Brate over the top behind the defense. Beautiful drive. What was it, 10 plays, 75 yards, you know, six passes, four runs, outstanding. Then you look at the next drive or a couple drives later, and Jameis Winston acts like he's throwing a dart into double or triple coverage. I can't remember exactly what it was, trying to get it to Mike Evans.
And like quintuple.
The only way Mike Evans can make that catch, he's going to get drilled. There was a defender behind him and in front of him, both coming at him. They're just going to scissor the hell out of him if he caught that ball. Either and they might have got a 15-yard penalty, and we might all have been, you know, yeah, that's a penalty, and give him 15 more yards. But Mike Evans might have got a concussion and left the game because there was no way Mike was gonna catch that pass. And on the TV broadcast, they showed right after that, they did a cut scene, you know, heading into commercial, and Mike Evans was screaming at something on the sideline. I asked all you guys if you knew what Mike Evans was yelling about. Nobody knew. I don't know either, but I'm wondering if he was yelling at Jameis saying, hey, dude, like, you're going to get me killed by doing that stuff. So, you know, and those are the moments where it's like Jameis just overthinks things, you know. So, again, I'm not in the meeting rooms. I'm not in the quarterback room watching film with Dirk and Jameis and all that. I don't know if Dirk is in the headset saying, hey, first read is 15 yards downfield, second read is 12, third read is 10. All right, if you get through all that and there's nothing there, go to the dump off. Because that's not, you know, that's not smart. That's not where this team is most effective, and that's not how things have been going. And I think that's where Jameis Winston, when he was alluding to learning by sitting on the sideline, had kind of having eye-opening moments, that's what we alluded to. We're not the only one. Pretty much every podcast I listen to, when they talked about those comments by Winston, that's what they were hoping he was talking about, is Fitzpatrick's calmness for one at the line, and two, his ability to see the field and say, okay, none of my deep reads are available, so let me look for a short one. Because sometimes, honestly, it kind of looks like Jameis is watching his receivers more than he's reading the defense, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, for sure.
And again, is this a coaching issue where he's not being coached how to read the field properly, or is this a Jameis Winston issue where he just is who he is, and that's the kind of guy that we're dealing with? Well, again, it all falls back on the head coach at the end of the day. You're the leader of this football team. I got it. You have figureheads. Jameis Winston's more popular than Dirk Cutter is. because that's just how our society works and all that. But at the end of the day, in an organizational structure, the head coach is the guy answering for the entire team, which is why I'm so critical of Dirk Koetter at this point in the season. If you have a quarterback, and I wrote about this a couple weeks ago in my film study, if you got a quarterback, let's just give Dirk Koetter the benefit of the doubt and say he's in the quarterback room saying, Jameis, look, you see how you're fixated downfield here, and you got seven defenders back there, and you got three receivers back there. That's when you need to be able to say, hey, let me come back down short and look underneath. Let's say that's the situation that's happening. This isn't actually a Dirk Koetter scheme issue. This is actually Jameis Winston refusing not to look downfield issue. If you're the head coach, you have got to learn that at some point in time. You've got to learn that about your guy. And you've got to change some of your scheme. You got to change some of your plays. You got to change some of the designs of what you're trying to do to fit him. And what I mean by that is send one or two guys downfield beyond the 8-yard mark or 10-yard mark or 12-yard mark, depending on down distance, all that, right? Because now you got a quarterback who's only got one or two reads downfield. And tell him, listen, dude, if this guy is covered, go to this guy. If he's covered, you need to look short. And you're only giving him two options. There's not four guys 15 yards downfield that he has a chance to get fixated on. Now there's only two. Or maybe there's only one on this route, you know, or in this route tree. You know what I mean? And simplify things for your quarterback that way and don't give him the opportunity. It's, I kind of look back at it as, you know, I can't come up with a really good analogy for it, but does that make sense what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So again, it comes back to the head coach either way, even if it's a Jameis Winston issue as the head coach and the, and essentially the offensive mastermind of what the Buccaneers are trying to do with the ball, you have got to find a way to make your system work for your quarterback.
Well, one more thing regarding the, is it a Jameis issue or is it a coaching issue before we jump over to the defense? Can we get a red zone target to somebody not named Cambrate? For the love of God, anytime the Bucs get inside the 20-yard line, the only receiver that Jameis looks for is Cambrate. You have Mike Evans, you have DeSean Jackson, you have Chris Godwin, who's come on strong. You have O.J. Howard. Why does he only zero in on Cambrate? It doesn't make any sense. Is it a situation where as soon as they get into that zone, Jameis just feels the most comfortable throwing to Brate, which to me doesn't really make a whole lot of sense considering how much success he and Mike Evans had in the red zone last year? Is it a situation where Koetter is making Brate the number one read on every red zone call that he has? I mean, it boggles my mind how they can have so many options, yet only one person ever gets the ball. And maybe, just maybe, that's why they've stalled inside the red zone so many times this season.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. And it's kind of the point almost where I hate seeing Cambrate run a seam route. You know, like I know he's really good at it. And don't get me wrong, it's successful enough for me to understand why the team keeps going back to it, because it is actually a pretty successful play. But man, like getting inside the 20-yard line, you know, I think probably every person that's watched the Buccaneers play is pretty much waiting to watch Cameron Brate streak down that, you know, those hashes and try to make a play over top of the defender. And again, you know, not to be a dead horse, but we get back to play design. Looking at that pass to the end zone, the Cambrate, where, you know, he sailed it over his head, that's really all he had a choice to do, because, and like you said, maybe it's a fixation on Cambrate by, you know, Jameis Winston, because looking at that play, I paused it and rewound it so many times just trying to look at it. And, you know, I don't have the all 22, so I'm just trying to get what I can from the camera angles that the network had. And there's a guy right on him. There's a guy in his hip pocket. There's a defender on top of him, and there's a defender underneath him. Why, you can't throw that. You know, like that's a triangle of death right there all day. And even if Cambrate can get his hand on there, you know, you're looking at some bruised ribs at a minimum. You know, I mean, that's just not a very high percentage, you know, shot that you're looking to take in there. But then, you know, I kept going back and I couldn't see the other side of the field. So like Mike Evans and maybe a running back might have leaked out, I don't know, you know, on the offensive right side of the field, but I could see the left side of the field because of the camera angle. And on the left side of the field, what I was able to notice is Adam Humphries comes open on a hitch route about 3 yards past the sticks. Because those three guys were on Cameron Brate, Adam Humphries is left wide open. So, and this isn't like the ball is in the air, defenders are reacting to Cam Brate, so Adam Humphries is open. No, this is Adam Humphries is open when the ball is, when Jameis Winston is going into his throwing motion. So if Jameis Winston, and this is what got me wondering if Jameis Winston is watching his receivers more than he's reading his defense, is because if Jameis Winston's reading the defense and you see that linebacker dropping down the middle of the field, the safety cheating over to the middle of the field, and that defender in your tight end's hip pocket, why are you throwing the ball there? Your eyes should immediately say, nope, too many guys in the middle. Because if you got three guys in the middle there, you got it no more than nine spread out throughout the rest of the field. You figure there's four rushing. So that's seven defenders that you just accounted for just on one read. You've got DeSean Jackson, Adam Humphries, Mike Evans, a running back, and, you know, run in wherever they're running. And they've only got four defenders. So now you're in a maximum position with one of your other four receivers because the defense, we just got done talking about this before we recorded, defenders are reacting. The offensive players are the ones who know what's about to happen. The defenders don't know what's about to happen. They just have to react. Well, find a guy who's in single coverage that's about to make a move and throw it to where that move should be and find your guy. And if he's looking at that defense and he comes right down the route, the route progression to the left to Adam Humphries, what he's going to see is that your man Adam is about to cut to the left and there's no defenders there. There's nobody there. Adam easily has a first down if he makes that catch and possibly, depending on the pursuit angles of the other defenders, could get a touchdown. But instead, just like what you said, there's a fascination with that deeper route. There's a fascination with apparently Cam Brate in the red zone and that seam route. And it reminds me of like the Orlando Magic shooting threes like they're the Golden State Warriors. Like, on occasion, yes, you're going to go on a streak and you're going to hit a bunch of threes. So on occasion, you're going to hit that seam route to Cam Brate and it's going to look beautiful. But for the most part, you're going to be the Orlando Magic and you're going to clank a whole bunch of threes. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what the seam route has turned into. And it's evident by the fact that the Green Bay Packers had three defenders dedicated to that seam route. So if you don't believe me sitting at home watching it saying I can see that seam route coming from a mile away, believe the Green Bay Packers who triple covered a tight end. Like, who triple covers a tight end? Nobody. Like, Jimmy Graham doesn't get triple covered. You know what I mean? Travis Kelce doesn't get triple covered. Why are you triple covering Cameron Brate? It's because the Buccaneers have shown such a tendency to run that play when they need 15 and more yards or when they need that touchdown so many times that it's fairly easy to see. So that's point one. Point two is DeSean Jackson. Again, I haven't seen the all 22, so this is all pre-22, right? So some of this stuff was blurry when I paused on my TV and so on and so forth. But if I'm correct in what I saw, DeSean Jackson ran a go route inside the 20. DeSean Jackson is not a strong receiver. DeSean Jackson is not a leap over your head for a pass receiver, right? So can you think of any reason why DeSean Jackson would run a go route inside the 20?
You got me.
You know what I mean? Because unless you're in like just flat out press coverage, and this dude just smokes his defender at the line of scrimmage and that ball's coming out before you even hit the third step in your drop, there's zero way that play is going to work. Like, you're basically just taking one of your own biggest weapons out of the play. You know, I mean, maybe it's a decoy and you're pushing that defender up the field to clear out for Adam Humphries. If that's the case, it worked beautifully, but you got to throw it there. You know what I'm saying? I don't know, man. Like I said, I'm not in the room. So I don't know if every time they run that seam, Dirt Cutter's like, look for the seam. If there's any white space, throw it in the white space. Or if Jameis Winston is just so obsessed with hitting that big play that he can't see anything else. I don't know what that problem is. If it's a Jameis Winston problem, kudos to Dirt Cutter for not throwing him under the bus. But if it's a Dirt Cutter problem, he's not fixing it. And even if it's a Jameis Winston problem, Dirt Cutter's not fixing it. So, you know, as a franchise, the Glazers have to make a decision with this conflict that's happening is, are we a Jameis Winston team or are we a Dirt Cutter team? Because if we're a Jameis Winston team, we got to find someone who's going to make this system work for Jameis Winston. If we're a Dirt Cutter team, then I'm not even going to go there.
That's a conversation for another day.
For another year. That's not a conversation for any time in the near future. So we're not even going to go there. But, you know, like I said, that's kind of where the Glazers have to attack this thing is there's got to be a fix somewhere. and someone's got to try to find it. But right now, nobody's trying to find anything. It doesn't look like, because, you know, Jameis is who Jameis is. And we saw, you know, like I said, the first drive of the game and like the second to or third to last drive of the game, we saw the checkdowns. We saw, you know, being satisfied with trying to make something happen with your feet more than trying to force things in, right? But for the majority of the game, we saw the same old Jameis. That's why there was a fumble. That's why, you know, there was another play where he was in the clutches of a defender and he went to fling the ball out of there and he kind of saw him go, wait, oh, not supposed to do that anymore. And then he took the sack, you know, so it showed, you know, today showed some progression in Jameis Winston's decision-making, but at the same time, there were some moments where Jameis is who Jameis is.
Well, David, real quick, before we jump over to a couple of Twitter comments that we received, the thoughts on the defense, I'll sum mine up pretty easily. Gerald McCoy is still fantastic. Lavonte David is still fantastic. Quan Alexander is struggling mightily. And Justin Evans is a lot of fun to watch, and I'm excited to see his continued development. Other than that, I have nothing else to say.
Yeah, most of my notes are on the offense today as well. The defense for the most part, and I got into a little bit of a conversation back and forth on Facebook with one of the readers earlier today or later this afternoon about this very topic, because, you know, someone wrote or someone commented on our immediate reaction and said, oh, there we go again, the defense screwing everything up. And I kind of wrote on there, well, you know, for the most part, the defense actually didn't do too bad up until the last drive of the game and then overtime. You know, and that's not to say that the defense doesn't hold their own bucket of blame here. I said in the very beginning of our episode that I think both sides deserve equal parts of the blame. But at the same time, let's not be so quick to blame everybody that we don't remember that this is a defense who they got gashed in the run game, but we're talking total game picture, right? We're talking total package. This team has given up on average 395 yards of offense per game, and they didn't give up. They gave up over 100 yards less this week to their opposing offense. Now, does that mean, like, when I say this defense did pretty well, I mean relative to this defense, right? Like relative to the 2017 Buccaneers defense, not relative to the 2017 Minnesota Vikings defense. Relative to our defense. Our defense did pretty well today relative to our defense. They gave up 13 points. If you give up 13 points in the National Football League in today's game, you should be able to win that game. You know, and they should have been able to win the game. Of course, you know, everybody walks off the field and that touchdown return by, was it Levy, the Packers defender? It counts.
Lowry,
there you go. Even though our defense didn't give it up, it still counts and it still goes towards a loss. Got it. But look at what our defense did. One touchdown, two field goals. You know, it's not a horrible game for the defense. Now, the ending was terrible, so I don't know what to tell you. But, and yeah, Gerald McCoy is a beast. Gerald McCoy is an all-pro for a reason, and every Bucs fan should just, I don't know, invest money in his jerseys.
Yeah, I mean, they held Brett Hundley to 77 passing yards.
Yeah. And I know Brett Hundley is not Carson Wentz, but he's still an NFL quarterback.
Right. However, they gave up basically 200 yards rushing.
Okay. See, and this is where I got in conversation with the guy on Facebook. So when I say that the defense did well, you know, relatively well, I'm talking about regulation. the last drive of the game in overtime, like, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about relatively well for the whole day, right?
Right.
They didn't give up almost 200 yards rushing in regulation. They gave up 100 and what was it, like 37 yards in regulation, which is still not great. But when you take 137 pat rushing yards with less than 100 rushing yards, you've got a pretty decent defensive day. You've got a defense that is keeping an offense from just moving up and down the field at will, and you're causing a little bit of frustration, at least, because no NFL team is just going to sit there and say, okay, let's just run our rookie running back 40 times today because that's the only thing that's working. A lot of those yards came during that overtime period where, yeah, I mean, let's just call it what it is. The Packers just ran over our defense and took the game and said, you know, we're done playing with you and this is what we're going to do. So,
yeah. 60 of the 72 yards on that overtime drive were rushing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Huntley had his career high in rushing yards today.
Right. So out of 100, would they end up with 179 combined yards for the Packers? You know, would you say 60 of those came in overtime? So, still not the greatest run defense performance of the year or the Buccaneers team history. But again, the defense did enough to hold the Packers in check that they should have won, that they had a chance to win that game. That's what you want a defense to do. When you don't have a dominant defense like the Vikings do, that's all you can ask them to do is don't give up so many points that we don't have a chance to win this game. Once you do that, that's what complimentary football is all about. The offense has now got to produce enough to do that, to win the game. And had we seen the offense that we saw operating in drive one, you know, kind of copy and paste throughout the game, I think that the Buccaneers definitely would have won the game. But that's not what we saw.
All right. Well, David, how about we jump over to a few Twitter comments and questions before we wrap things up here on a not-so-victory Monday?
Yeah, so we had a lot of interesting stuff, and you know we said it on Twitter when we asked for you guys questions and comments that we wouldn't be able to get to them all, but we kind of picked out a few that kind of encompassed what everybody was kind of saying.
The general feeling of the sad Buccaneers Twitter family.
Yeah, exactly. So let's see the first one I'm going to read off here is Michael Parr at GoBucks4Life. That's the number 4 in there. And here's what he says. He says, I'll admit that I've been very quick to call for people to get fired in the past. 10 years of no playoffs has made me impatient. I didn't think there was any scenario that would make me do that this year, but we need changes. Too much talent to be 4-8. #Bucks.
Yeah, I actually mentioned this in my pick six column that dropped this morning. And that is, I have fought tooth and nail against the Gruden gang because I don't believe John Gruden is the answer. Mm-hmm. I have fought tooth and nail against the let's fire coaches every other year because that's what the Buccaneers do now, because that's not the answer. You can't keep rotating coaching staffs every 2 years and expect excellence.
Yeah.
But like our buddy Trevor Sikkema said on the last episode of the Walking the Plank podcast, if you don't have the guy, you don't have the guy.
Right.
And I don't think Cutter and his staff are the answer either. I don't like the idea of changing coaches again. I don't like the idea of going through a coaching search. I don't like the idea of Jameis having to go through an entire system change along with the offense, and yeah, is it going to work right away? Same with the defense. I mean, I've lost count of how many different defensive schemes Gerald McCoy has had to play in.
And he's successful in all of them.
He is that, but don't tell that to the people that hate Gerald McCoy because you'll ruin their day.
If you hate Gerald McCoy, you hate good people. Like... Well, Jamie, I think we're getting short on time. So, okay. Do you want to save the rest of these for tomorrow night, or do you want to hit one more and then save the others for tomorrow night? Because we got a few more that we wanted to get to.
Let's hit one more tonight, and then we'll hit the rest tomorrow night.
All right. Do you want to hit up Evan Smith, Julio Jones, or Chris Godwin?
Let's go Godwin.
Godwin. Okay. So good. So Mike Kiwak. Right. He was my first editor when I started doing blogging and writing about the Buccaneers. Was chatting with me today on Twitter as the game was going on. And he asked me a multitude of questions, actually, which we're going to get to, you know, later on down the line. But the one we're going to talk about tonight is specific to Chris Godwin. And here's what he said. He said, why has Chris Godwin received such limited snaps when it's clear he's ready for more?
I don't have a good answer for that because I do see exactly what he's talking about. Now, I will say that we have seen Godwin's role slowly increase as the season has progressed. I think we will continue to see that. But when they can't utilize weapons like Mike Evans and DeSean Jackson properly, they can't utilize O.J. Howard except like once every 3 weeks, it's hard to throw yet another kink into that mix. So I do like the slow progression of Godwin's usage. I do think we're going to get more. I think, as we talked about on one of the roundtables at thepeterplank.com, I think Chris Godwin is a big reason why we're not going to see Adam Humphries back next season. I would love to see more of him this year. I don't think we will. I think he's kind of, this is who we have in Godwin this season. But moving forward, I think there's a lot of promise for Godwin as the, you know, the basically the number two receiver opposite of Mike Evans, because I think they'll end up sliding DeSean Jackson more into the slot role because Godwin doesn't really fit that mold all that much. But that's not to say he's not versatile enough to play out of the slot. I mean, in the NFL anymore, they rotate so many of these guys into the slot. Even Julio plays out of the slot sometimes. So yeah. I think we're in for a huge increase in Godwin snaps next season.
Yep. So 100% ditto. So pretty much everything you just said, say it again in my voice. And that's what I think about Chris Godwin.
All right. And before we wrap things up real quick, a special shout out and a big thank you to on Twitter. His name is Michael Myers here. His Twitter handle is at Myers was here. And he had a lot of really kind things to say about this podcast, about the Walking the Plank podcast. He was real excited to join in on the instant cast. He's a big fan of things that we do at the Pewter Plank and within the Pewter Plank family, including Brent Allen and Ren over at the Pewter Cast. So a big thank you to him for all his support and his kind words. So with that, David, we are going to go ahead and wrap things up, and we're going to save some things for tomorrow. We ran long yet again. We're going to get this timing thing down at some point.
It's hard. Give us a week. Give us a week to figure it out.
It's hard for us to go from doing, you know, 90 to 120 minute shows down to trying to drop it between 20 and 30 minutes. But we'd like to thank each and every one of you for joining us. Once again, follow us on Twitter at the Pewter Plank, at Locked On Bucks. I am at @JYarko_Bucks. And David is at @DH82_Bucks. And we will talk to you all again Tuesday right here at the Locked On Bucks podcast.